Hey, it's great to see you, whether you're here in the room or joining us online. An honor to have you along for the ride. We're in the second week of a series called How They Do It, in which we're exploring what I believe to be the secret sauce of enviable relationships. You know those couples you see from time to time that really seem to have figured out the path to happiness? And for the benefit of those of you joining us for the first time today, like you heard about the hot dogs and the pony rides, I get that. That's good. But I want to take a few minutes to review what we covered last week, because last week was sort of a cliffhanger, if you were with us, right? I said there's four ways that we respond to conflict. Three of them don't work, and we talked about those last week. Very helpful message, I know. But then this week, we're going to actually talk about one that I think does help. So last week kind of provided the foundation, the framework. So just a brief review. Last week, we talked about how whether we recognize it or not, and I would argue we often don't, we all come into relationships with an invisible box of hopes and dreams and desires. And here's what I mean by that. If you took some time right now to think about it and you sat down with a cup of coffee, I bet you could outline what you want your future to look like. I mean, you likely have an idea of how much money you're gonna have and how you're gonna spend it and where you'll live and what color minivan you'll drive and right, and how you're gonna handle conflict, whether or not you'll have children. And that's all good. But the challenge with our box of hopes, dreams, and desires when it comes to our most significant relationship is that, I'll put it this way, when we're single, we don't tend to daydream about becoming the perfect person for someone else. We daydream about finding the perfect person for us, right? I mean, if I'm being honest, that's true of me. Back when I was working as a hair model in the late 1990s, Why is that funny? They laughed first service too. Anyway, I remember thinking, I met Sarah Ann and I thought, oh my goodness, she's perfect for me. And so eventually I bought a ring and I brought the ring along with my invisible box of hopes, dreams, and desires to our wedding. I thought it was going to be great. But here's the thing. As I walked down the aisle with her that day, everything in my box seemed perfectly reasonable to me. And so I thought, why wouldn't she want to organize her life around what's in my box? But here's the challenge. As it turns out, Sarah Ann brought her box to our wedding too. And everything in her box seemed perfectly reasonable to her too. Like, and we all do this. It's a tale as old as time, as they say, right? But the challenge is that once we get into a significant dating relationship or marriage relationship, we eventually hand our box of hopes, dreams, and desires to our partner. And when we do, it does not feel like hopes, dreams, and desires to them. It feels like expectations. Same box, different experience, right? It feels like pressure for them to help us build our preferred future. And maybe it's a preferred future like the one that we were raised in, or it may be a preferred future that's nothing like the one we experienced when we were growing up. But either way, as soon as we try to shape our future based on our hopes, dreams, and desires, our partner feels as though we've placed expectations on them. And when that happens, couples struggle. Like almost all couples struggle with this, and then they usually begin to negotiate and bargain and maybe even bribe one another to get their way. Maybe you've had this experience. You say something like, well, if you will, then I will. And if you'll do it the way I want to do it, then hey, we can avoid conflict. Or if you'll stay within my budget, then maybe one day we could actually live the way that you want to live. But see, as we noted last week, whenever that bargaining, negotiating thing happens, the relationship can quickly degenerate into one defined by the dynamics of debt and debtor. Each partner starts to think, you owe me. Like, that's what husbands are supposed to do. That's what wives are supposed to do. That's what men are supposed to do. That's how women are supposed to respond. You owe me. But see, the problem is that when this dynamic takes root in a relationship, it becomes functionally impossible to recognize love. Like, you can't really give it and you can't really receive it because you can't appreciate it or recognize it. Let me explain that this way. If you owe me some money, right, and then you give me some money, I don't see it as a gift. I see it as a payment on your debt. I mean, if you owe me and you come to me after service, I mean, I so appreciate how you've been working up these talks, and I just want to give you $100 to thank you. That's great, but I'm telling you, if you owe me more than $100, not only am I not grateful, I don't see it as a gift, and I want to know when I'm going to get the rest of what you owe me, right? So consequently, gratitude in these situations is pretty much non-existent. And that's why in relationships that take on this debtor dynamic, it's almost impossible to extend and receive love. And so that said, I guess the question that we need to concern ourselves with is, how do we keep this from happening in our most significant relationship? Like, how do we keep our legitimate hopes, dreams, and desires from feeling like expectations to our partners? And the answer that we talked about last week is basically we must choose to believe that we owe our partners everything and they owe us nothing in return. Seriously, that's one of the ways that couples with enviable relationships do it. And if you are wondering how anyone would ever figure that out, like it's so counterintuitive, you should know that it's an idea that's right at the center of what Jesus taught about relationships in general. And so if you're here and you're at a season of your life where you're like, this is great, relationship series, love it for everybody else, I am never going to do a relationship again, I hear you, I see you, just know that these principles will apply to all your relationships, but they are particularly potent in the context of dating and marriage. And so, again, this is an idea that's right at the heart of the Jesus movement. And so he introduced it on the night that he was betrayed by one of his closest friends, on the night he had that last supper with his disciples. So at some point during that meal, he looked at them and he said, okay, guys, a new command I give you. And it's super easy for us to miss, but this simple statement, many of us have it memorized, would have been beyond offensive to Jesus' first followers. In fact, it wouldn't surprise me if a few of them had been tempted to unfollow Jesus after he said this. Because, you know, they were, most of them, Jewish teenage boys. Peter was maybe in his early 20s. But they had grown up in synagogue, and they had been taught their whole life that the only one who could give new commands was God. And God had already given all the commands to his people through Moses, like 1,500 years before the time of Jesus. And so that night they would have thought, come on, Jesus. I mean, you can talk about the commands, you can prioritize them, you can teach us how to apply them in our lives. But you can't make up new ones. No one can. Nonetheless, Jesus said, a new command I give you. And then he said this, love one another. And they would have thought, I see what you did there. That's not new. That's from Leviticus, right? And Jesus would have thought, I'm not done. Keep listening. Here's what the rest of it says, right? Love one another as I have loved you, so you must love one another. It's a very specific type of love. I think it would have sucked the air out of the room because the disciples would have each been flooded with memories of how Jesus had loved specifically them, specifically at moments when they were not at their best. But he looks at them and he says, listen, at the end of the day, this is how I want you to live. You are to treat other people the way that I have treated you. And then as he looked at their eyes going around the table, he could have looked at each of them and reminded them of what that had looked like. He could have said to Matthew, hey, Matthew, do you remember when we first met? Bro, you were a tax collector, right? You were an embarrassment to your family and your nation and your mama, right? And do you remember what I said when I met you? And Matthew would have looked back and he had to answer, you asked me to follow you, like right from the tax collector's booth. And Jesus could have looked next to him and said, hey, Peter, do you remember how you didn't want Matthew to follow me? Because you didn't want Matthew to be associated with us. You didn't want to be associated with a tax collector. And Peter would have looked at his shoes or sandals or whatever he was wearing and said, yeah, I remember that. Jesus could have said, and remember, I let you both stay in the club even after that. And then Matthew, do you remember where we went right after I invited you to follow me? And Matthew had to say, well, yeah, we went to my house. And just said, and you remember who you invited to join us? And then Peter could have interjected, I remember who he invited, all of his gross tax collector friends. It was the worst day of my life. And Jesus could have said, Peter, I want you to extend that same posture, that same sort of grace and mercy to every single person you meet for the rest of your life. And then going around the table, he would have locked eyes with Nathaniel and said, hey, Nathaniel, do you remember when we met? Remember how you pretty much dissed my entire family? It's not a real famous Bible story, but in a man named John's account of the life of Jesus, he records that when Nathaniel first heard about Jesus, hadn't even seen him yet, just heard about him and learned where he had come from, he said this, Nazareth, that's the name of the town, can anything good come from there? So Jesus could have said, remember when you dissed my hometown? Like you made us sound like a bunch of losers. Remember that? And Nathaniel would have had to answer, yeah, I do. And then Jesus could have said, and yet I still invited you to follow me, and I never brought it up again until right now. But the hypothetical, they didn't have the conversation, right? But I'm telling you, Jesus could have run around that entire room and said, from now on, I want you to think about how I treated you, and that's how I want you to treat everybody else. Even your enemies. And then, a few hours later, Jesus was arrested, and he was tried, and he was falsely convicted, and then he gave his life on their behalf and our behalf. And his words would have rung in their ears and our ears. He's like, if you want to follow me, you need to give your life for the benefit of others, because that's how I treated you. In fact, I was thinking about it this week, and I just want to make it simple for all of us to remember. I mean, if you're a Christian, and this is just super practical, but if you're a Christian, when you're not sure what to say or do, which is all of us all the time, right? Just love like Jesus loved you. When you're not sure what to say or do, just love like Jesus loved you. I even had this idea this week. We could make some bracelets with W. I'm just kidding. Yeah. But no, when you're not sure what to say or do, love like Jesus loved you. That's it. That's the marching orders. Just ask yourself, how did Jesus treat me when I was misbehaving or broke a promise or was unfaithful? How did he treat me? When you're not sure what to do, just love like Jesus loved you. This is the big one. It's what he wants you to do if you are a Jesus follower. And it's the message that launched that early church. And what's so fascinating to me is then a couple decades later, there's a pastor named Paul who came along, and he took that core idea of Jesus, to love like we've been loved, and he began to apply it in letters to early Jesus followers all over the northern Mediterranean. And he applied it to all different kinds of relationships. And this is so important for us to understand. Whenever you read something that Paul wrote in his letters that instructed Jesus followers to do something or to stop doing something, you need to remember that every one of his commands is simply a context-specific application of Jesus' new command to treat other people the way he had treated them. In other words, Paul wasn't making up new commands. He was simply applying Jesus' new command. And to our point for this series, in a letter to early Christians living in a major city called Ephesus, Paul applied Jesus' new command to marriages. And I'm telling you, this is so helpful. It's incredibly clarifying on so many levels. So check out with me what Paul wrote when it comes to the marriage relationship. He says, if you want to do marriage like Jesus wants you to do marriage, here you go. Write this down. Wives, hang with me, ladies. Wives, I promise it gets better. Wives, first service, two people got up and walked out. I checked. They both had to go to the bathroom. I was like, fine. Yeah, I was safe place. If you're new around here, like, yeah. They're like, oh, I see where he's going here. Yeah. Wives, submit. My wife is here first service. Okay, now I'm going to tell you. Wives, submit yourselves to your own husbands as you do to the Lord. And like, I remember thinking like, yeah, what could be clearer than that? We could just pray and go home. No. If this verse bothers you, good. In fact, I bet a few of you would confess to me over coffee, dude, this is why I stopped going to church years ago. This idea is why I don't always like Christians, right? So if that's what you're feeling, what you're about to hear, you are going to love, because as it turns out, Paul wasn't actually saying what it looks like he's saying here. And here's why. As you may or may not know, our English Bibles are translations from ancient Greek manuscripts. And if you translate the oldest Greek manuscripts of this verse, like word for word, it reads like this. Wives, to your own husbands as to the Lord. And I know what you're thinking. Where is the verb? It's not there. The word submit is not in the earliest manuscripts. And before I explain why it's not there, I need to explain something else. And this is so, so important. When Paul's original audience heard his instruction for wives to submit to their husbands, they would have thought, duh, not huh. Thank you. I was excited all week for that slide. Duh, not huh. In other words, the wives would have thought, tell us something we don't know, Paul. Like, this isn't a big deal. This is common knowledge. In fact, you should know, this idea didn't surprise or offend anyone in Paul's original audience, because in both the Roman world and in the Jewish culture, they had embraced something that's referred to as patria, whatever that word is, right? It sounds like a spell from Harry Potter. I know, right? But that's what it was, which is basically the idea that men had legal jurisdiction over their children and their wives. So wives in the Roman world essentially belonged to their husbands. So when Paul instructed wives to submit to their husbands, they would have thought, right, because if we don't, they'll sell us or trade us or have us arrested and accused of a crime and there won't be any witnesses. I mean, of course we'll submit to our husbands. What other choice do we have? So this was not a big deal to them. But here's what's so cool. It's a big deal to us. And the reason it's a big deal to us is what comes next. But before I show you what comes next, let's return briefly to the question of why there isn't a verb in this verse. It's because the verb is actually found in the previous verse, in like the one right before that verse. And this was actually a typical Greek grammatical construction. Authors made like a big idea statement with the verb, and then in the subsequent statements, that same verb is implied. So what was the verse that came before the wives submit to your husbands that gives us the verb for that verse? Well, the verse that set the tone that followed reads like this. Paul wrote, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. In other words, in a relationship that reflects Jesus' intentions, the submission is mutual. Moreover, the word reverence, he says submit to one another out of reverence for Christ, that conveys a sense of awe. In other words, Paul wrote that, like, in light of all that God has done for you, in light of the awe that comes from acknowledging Jesus died for my sins when I was at my most unworthy, he made me worthy. All that awe is to be translated not simply to church attendance or singing songs heavenward, but also into love for other people. That's why Christian marriage is essentially supposed to be a submission competition. He submits to her, she submits to him, rinse and repeat. And by the way, this is how they do it. Couples in enviable relationships know that they are there to serve their partner without demanding that their partner serve them. They are to leverage their resources and their talents and their gifts for the benefit of their partner. And to be fair, in a marriage, there may be different roles within the relationship based on different gifts and talents, but here's, and this is so huge, they don't have different value. Different roles, not different value. And I'm telling you, in the first century Roman world, this thinking was unprecedented, and Jesus was the model. So if you think about it, what Paul did in this passage when he communicated this truth for the first time, it was brilliant. Because like all good communicators, he started with common ground to sort of get everyone in his audience nodding along. And that was that instruction for wives to submit to your husbands, right? To put their hopes and dreams and desires ahead of their own. But see, what came next, that would have been shocking. In fact, I think what came next would have had the same effect on Paul's original audience that his instructions for wives to submit their husbands has on us. So here's what Paul said next. He wrote, husbands, love your wives. And we think, of course. But in the first century, it wasn't of course. Husbands would have thought, wait a minute, I don't have an obligation to do anything for my wife. My wife has obligations to love and serve me. And then Paul continued, it got better. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. And all those Christian guys in Ephesus would have thought, wait a minute, I know this story, right? It did not end well for Jesus. And are you seriously suggesting that we have a responsibility to sacrifice for our wives? Are you inferring, Paul, that there might even be a sense of equality in our relationship? Where are you going with this? And then Paul he gets real spicy. He says this: in the same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. In other words, Paul says, okay, huddle up, guys. I'm going to make this super simple for you. You are responsible to protect your wife as if she is you. And I'm telling you, they would have thought, come on, Paul, you can't be serious. And if they had asked him, Paul would have said, listen, there is a mystery at the heart of marriage. And it goes all the way back to the beginning. When a man and a woman join together in marriage to become one. So there's no division anymore. Men, your wives are one with you. And so let me bring it back to us for a moment. The reason that we bristle when we read wives submit to your husbands is because our culture, Western culture in general, has at least somewhat embraced the equality of men and women. And the reason Western culture has at least somewhat embraced the equality of men and women is Jesus. And I'm telling you, this is why I think every woman should be a follower of Jesus. That's a little playful. I think everybody should be a follower of Jesus. But specifically women, he argued for your value and your worth and your dignity before it became a category for anyone in the world. In fact, let me show you just one more example of this. It's just so much fun. One day, Jesus was teaching, and some stuffy Jewish religious leaders asked him a question. And it's really, really telling as to how they saw things. So they asked this question. They said, Jesus, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? And I know we hear that and we're like, what? But in the first century, there was a group of stuffy religious leaders who taught that a man could just simply say, I divorce you, three times to his wife, and they would be legally divorced. And this could happen for any reason. She burns the toast. I don't know if they had toast back then, but you get the idea, right? She kicks over a bucket of water. She doesn't get home on time. Or simply because he was tired of her. And so there was this group of religious leaders who believed that Moses had taught that a man could divorce his wife for any reason at all. And so they asked Jesus to weigh in on their perspective. And Jesus looked back at them and essentially responded, hey guys, I hate to tell you this, but ideally there's no reason to divorce because a married couple is one. Now, go home and treat her like you treat yourself. And they would have thought, I don't think you heard our question, Jesus. We're looking for like a list of reasons, and you pointed us to the fact that when two become one, there isn't really a good reason, ideally. And Jesus would have thought, I think they're catching on. And he might look back at them and say, listen, you're asking this question because you think men are worth more than women, but they're not. And that's why if you study church history, so many women flocked to the Jesus movement because he gave them value and he said they could have purpose in this world. Jesus introduced the concept of equal value for men and women, and then Paul articulated it in the context of marriage. And to be fair, it took the church a long time to catch on. And in some places, it's still taking the church a long time to catch up with this teaching. But nonetheless, the fact that our society values both men and women, that is not natural. If you think about it, there's parts of the world today that women are still treated in the same way they were in the first century. So back to Paul. What was his point in this letter to the Christians in Ephesus, specifically as it pertains to this series? I think it's fair to say that his point to the husbands of Ephesus was that their wives need to be their top priority. And obviously that can't happen if they have a big box of expectations that they've handed her. And I think his point to the wives of Ephesus was that they couldn't really submit to their husbands if they had a big box of expectations that they've handed him. So that said, once again, our question this week goes like this. Like, okay, given all that, that all makes sense, and I get handing my box to someone else becomes expectations, but then, okay, still unanswered, what should we do with our hopes and dreams and desires? And I think we've uncovered two suggestions The first is to remind ourselves that our partner owes us nothing and we owe them everything. So that was last week. And then the second thing this week, like for this to work, and this is the key, it has to be mutual. Like the submission has to go both ways. Because Paul wrote, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. And I'm telling you, this is what oneness in a relationship looks like. His or her best over yours. And so now, you may recall this. Last week, I left you with two questions to ask yourself, right? I asked you to consider, like, okay, what's in my box? And of my box of hopes, dreams, and desires, and then have I unintentionally handed it to someone who I'm expecting to fulfill them? That was our question last week, to ask the questions of yourself. And a few of you reached out, and this is super fun, because you got so excited, you actually asked your partner what was in their box, and your partner responded something like, he told us we didn't have to do that. It's just, this is a for me, I remember, and they like, one person even pulled up the sermon clip and is like, listen, here it is. And I was like, wow, that's pretty hardcore. But I say that because now you are no longer off the hook, right? Your assignment for this week is to ask your partner what's in your box. So not what's in your box, what's in their box. And just a couple quick things. I would not suggest that you ask them on the way home, okay? Like, wait. Some of you are like, I can't wait, salivating. Yeah, wait for the right time. And a fair warning, guys, your wife may faint when you ask her, okay? Or she might get mad. She might think, dude, we've been married for 20 years and you still don't know what's in my box. And if that happens, here's my advice as a husband. Just take the hit because you have been married for 20 years and you don't know what's in her box, right? Because you've been preoccupied with why she doesn't deal out of your box. So just ask and maybe brace yourself, that's fair, and listen, okay? And ladies, a couple things. If you ask your man what's in his box, I can almost guarantee you he's going to say nothing, okay? He's not lying. He doesn't know, right? It's true. And even if he did the thing last week, he probably only half did it because that's what guys do. But anyway, even though he expects you to fulfill his wishes, dreams, and desires that he's never defined, okay? And ladies, one more thing. This is something about us guys. We are scared to talk about this, but we need to. So what I really want to challenge you to do this week is to find out what's in your partner's box. And if you're concerned about what happens to all of your hopes, dreams, and desires, because that's still an unanswered question kind of hanging there, we're going to talk about that next week. So you don't want to miss next week. And so with that, I'd love to invite you to stand, and I'll close our time in prayer. Also this week, every week we have friends under the screen to the left. If you came into this place and need to pray with someone or talk with someone, it's been an interesting week. It's been a hard week in our country, and so just want to make that available to you. For the rest of us, let me close our time in prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you for being our lighthouse in a world that so often feels chaotic. I pray that as we lean into the way of your Son, we would find order coming out of the chaos of our marriage relationships. And as we follow your Son, I pray that we would see order coming out of the chaos of our families and in our culture. Thank you for showing us the way, not just teaching us the way, but then providing an example for us to follow. Thank you as well for the grace in which we stand when we fail, because if we're being honest, we all fail. And thank you for the invitation to get back up and to try again. But for this moment, just thank you for this community. Thank you for the freedom to gather and to explore these ideas, and thank you for the freedom to begin to apply them in our lives. And as we do, I pray that we would find you faithful because you always are faithful. So I pray a blessing on us all in the matchless name of your Son, our Savior, Jesus Christ. Everyone said, amen. And on your way out, friends, there's food and horse rides. So go get them. Yeehaw.